Raw almonds. Raw walnuts. Avoid the worst fats. We recommend that you do not feed your family foods that contain any trans fats. You may know trans fats as shortening, margarine, or other substances that contain partially hydrogenated vegetable oils. Their use is widespread. They're in everything from French fries and microwave popcorn to cookies, cakes, and fast food. Trans fats are substantially worse for human health than ordinary butter. They have been implicated in many illnesses, including diabetes, allergies, and heart disease. Used widely by commercial food manufacturers and restaurants because they extend the shelf life of processed foods, it's hard to avoid them. Yet scientists have found no safe level of consumption of these fats, and reputable researchers advise against including them in your diet. However, just because a product label says no trans fats doesn't necessarily mean there are none in that product. Products sold in the United States are legally allowed to bear the label no trans fats if they have less than a certain amount of trans fats per serving. So if you or your child eats multiple servings of that product, you're still getting unhealthy levels. Check all labels for partially hydrogenated vegetable oil, shortening, and margarine to determine whether there are any trans fats in the product you're considering buying. What's in your dinner? Even though fish oil is sorely lacking from the American diet, don't run out and buy a slab of swordfish or tuna to grill up for the family dinner tonight. Extremely large fish, such as these, are among those most contaminated by mercury, a neurotoxin that damages the brain. Children under the age of 6 are particularly vulnerable to its effects. Before you feed your family fish, find out which types are safest to consume. One way to do that is by consulting consumer protection websites, for example, gotmercury.org. Children are also more sensitive than adults to environmental poisons, such as pesticides and weed killers. Before spraying them in any area of your home or yard, explore non-toxic options. Children even get significant exposure to pesticides through the foods they eat. Switching to organic foods has an immediate effect in reducing the toxins circulating in their bodies. Since organics cost more than conventionally grown foods, you can save money by prioritizing the most contaminated choices. Get more information by visiting websites such as foodnews.org. Neurotransmitters. Neurotransmitters are the primary data messengers in our brains. They circulate between nerve cells and receptor sites, sending tiny electrical charges to transmit information throughout our gray matter. There are two basic categories of neurotransmitters. One group revs up our nervous system, called excitatory neurotransmitters. The other group calms it down, called inhibitory neurotransmitters. Keeping the right balance between the two systems is critical to good mental health. When imbalances occur, we experience them as mood swings, cloudy thinking, or behavioral aberrations. Psychiatric medications are typically designed to improve mental health by manipulating neurotransmitter levels and actions. There are dozens of distinct neurotransmitters in the brain. Poor diet and chronic stress are among the leading causes of neurotransmitter imbalances. Unfortunately, when neurotransmitter balance is compromised, it can be hard to pinpoint where the process has unraveled. For example, there may not be enough raw material, that is, nutrients from the right foods, to produce the needed neurotransmitters. Or perhaps nerve cells aren't transforming available nutrients into neurotransmitters efficiently. In other cases, receptor sites become voraciously hungry and deplete the supply too quickly. To further complicate matters, neurotransmitters work best in certain relative ratios, and adjusting one can have unintended consequences further along down the line for another. These intricate interrelationships make finding the right therapeutic intervention a process of trial and error. Neurochemical impact of early deprivation and abuse. Early deprivation and abuse can disrupt the way a growing child's body and brain develop, even the way the body produces and manages neurotransmitters. Infants who were abused before the age of 2 have endured structural changes in the right hemisphere of the brain, which in turn affect their ongoing ability to cope with stress. We've seen similarly distorted neurotransmitter profiles in children we work with years after they've been adopted into secure homes. Even though they're living in a safe and loving family environment, their neurochemistry can be wildly irregular. It's as if the prior trauma has left its fingerprints in these children's brains. The resulting neurotransmitter imbalances make it physically difficult for formerly harmed children to maintain a relaxed and happy mood and cause them to get easily excited and distressed. For an idea of how mood can be hijacked by imbalances of neurotransmitters, think of a time when you were exceptionally angry, so furious that your heart was pounding and you couldn't focus on anything else. It was at that moment that excitatory fight-or-flight neurotransmitters, such as epinephrine, were flooding your body to help you respond to the perceived threat. But what happened 10 minutes later, when the source of your anger was already gone? Your heart was still pounding. It can take 20 minutes or more for calming neurotransmitters to overtake the excitatory flood and bring you back to a more tranquil state. Many children who come from hard places, however, are stuck in the imbalanced state. Their biochemistry has difficulty self-correcting, so they feel the ups and downs more dramatically than other people do. These children struggle, physically, just to keep their emotions on an even keel. Neurotransmitter levels can be professionally evaluated through urine tests and other means. These levels may help reveal what's driving your child's behavioral problems and the efficacy of various treatment interventions. Histamine, allergies, and behavior. Histamine is one of the excitatory neurotransmitters. It contributes to allergic reactions and is also involved in attention and alertness. Notice that many antihistamine drugs that reduce hay fever and allergy symptoms also cause drowsiness. An excess of histamine can be linked not only to allergic reactions, but to concurrent behavioral problems. Our own study of 97 adopted at-risk children revealed that the children with the worst behavioral problems also had the highest histamine levels. It pays to look for undiagnosed allergies that might be contributing to your child's poor behavior. We visited a residential treatment center for children where we were hit by the powerful smell of mildew coming from a basement playroom. Staff acknowledged that whenever they brought kids down to that room to play, the youngsters got out of control. At least one child would inevitably end up in a padded seclusion room for aggressive behavior. Now that the treatment center has cleaned up the mold problem, playtime in that room has become more tranquil. Behavioral intervention can improve brain chemistry. Our research suggests it's possible to improve youngsters' brain chemistry simply by using behavioral interventions. Helping children feel safe, engaging them in sensory activities, teaching them new social skills, and helping them to connect with their parents. Cammy came from Russia at almost 11 months old, and her behavior was difficult from the start. When she was 5 years old, physicians diagnosed her as having reactive attachment disorder and early onset bipolar disorder. Cammy took her first neurotransmitter test just before her family began an intensive behavioral intervention with us, and she took her second neurotransmitter test 20 days later. During this period, the little girl took no medications. On the first test date, little Cammy was irritable, volatile, explosive, and aggressive. Anger was the only emotion she expressed. She battered her siblings and threw tantrums with little provocation. She never showed sadness or fear and refused all affection from her parents, not even allowing herself to be rocked to sleep. The family walked on eggshells around her. 20 days into the intensive intervention, Cammy's behavior had taken a dramatic turn for the better. Notice that excitatory dopamine and PEA, beta-phenylethylamine, dropped. These correspond with Cammy's improved interaction with her family. She had begun snuggling with her parents, giving genuine affection, using words to express herself, and offering soft eye contact. She was throwing far fewer tantrums and sleeping better at night. This was the beginning of secure attachment with her parents and loving relationships with her siblings. The family stayed on the intensive program for several months and continues to use the general principles presented in this book. Strong-willed Cammy is now a cooperative and happy family member who dotes on her siblings and enjoys many positive social connections. Targeted amino acid therapy. Some researchers are investigating a customized alternative nutritional approach to optimizing brain chemistry. Called targeted amino acid therapy, TAAT, this method provides nutritional supplementation of carefully chosen amino acids, the building blocks of protein, plus specific vitamins and minerals. The idea is to provide raw materials in amounts that allow the body to synthesize its own supply of missing neurotransmitters. Our own research team has explored the value of TAAT supplementation for high-risk adopted children. Targeted amino acid therapy can be delivered either by combining over-the-counter nutritional products or using pre-balanced supplements designed for this purpose, such as the Neuroscience Inc. supplements used in our study. The guidance of a medical professional or nutritionist is critically important when undertaking TAAT because of the delicately balanced interaction between various proteins, minerals, and vitamins. In our study of 97 children, the youngsters who received TAAT supplements had fewer attention problems, less anxiety and depression, fewer acting out episodes, and less aggression than the control group. No behavioral interventions were administered during the test period. Among our findings, we noted, at the beginning of the study, these children showed PEA at approximately 3 times the normal, healthy level. At the conclusion of the 60-day test period, the treated group's PEA levels had dropped about 8%, while the untreated control group's PEA had risen nearly 40%. Remember that an excess of the neurotransmitter PEA is associated with thinking disorders and racing thoughts. At the start of the study, virtually all the participants averaged serotonin, the feel-good neurotransmitter, levels below the desirable range. 60 days later, serotonin levels of the treatment group roughly doubled into the therapeutic range. Serotonin levels of the control group remained virtually unchanged. The study benefits were particularly notable when you take into account that the pretest occurred during the summer, a relatively tranquil time for children, while the post-test occurred during the first couple of weeks of a new school year, a stressful time for many children. Getting your child started. You don't need a fancy or expensive protocol to start your child on nutritional supplements that can have powerful behavioral and biochemical benefits. Your child can benefit from regularly receiving a high-quality multivitamin, free of added colorings and additives, capsules containing a fish oil blend of essential fatty acids. If a fishy aftertaste is bothersome, try enteric-coated capsules or keep the capsules frozen. A liquid mineral supplement and probiotics such as Acidophilus are also helpful for many children. Be mindful to include iron only under the guidance of your doctor. You may also want to consider consulting with your doctor or a nutritional specialist who can provide a more customized approach for your child. Chapter 11. Handling Setbacks. Don't despair if things aren't going as smoothly as you'd like when you begin to implement the techniques outlined in this book. Learning is never a perfectly linear effort. You may see your child making great strides, then feel as if he or she is stuck or even backsliding. Progress naturally zigs and zags. Mistakes are an inherent and valuable part of the learning process. The greatest advances often come after a period of intense frustration and setbacks. By expecting and planning for setbacks, you'll make them less disruptive. When they do occur, watch and look for any recognizable patterns. Perhaps they happen most often when your child is exhausted or on days when you do certain activities. By identifying trigger situations, you can better avoid or minimize those obstacles in the future. On days when you're feeling frustrated, don't let fear of failure discourage you from sticking with these methods. Just as with any new skill, these skills take practice for both you and your child. The process of stumbling and getting back on track has therapeutic value. On a neurological level, self-correction and repetition help the brain cement pathways involved in learning new skills. And the process of a parent and child briefly disconnecting and then reconnecting again can actually contribute to a child's emotional resilience. Together, as partners, you and your child are learning to do a new dance. You might step on each other's toes and feel clumsy in the beginning. But with practice, the steps become second nature, and you can enjoy the music as you both move with ease. Recognizing progress. Sometimes parents are making great progress in working with their child, but don't recognize it. They may be feeling stressed themselves. Inadvertently, they have gotten stuck in the memory of their child's past behavior. Keep in mind that success can creep up on you in small increments. We often find that parents aren't recognizing how well things are actually going. Here are a few signs of success to watch for. Your usually excitable child calms down for increasing lengths of time. While you're playing a game, you and your child laugh and smile together. Your child makes warm eye contact or spontaneously hugs you. Your child cooperates and follows instructions. Use visual reinforcements to acknowledge small gains. For example, each time your daughter is particularly cooperative during the day, you might put a sticker on the calendar. We prefer a 6-inch by 9-inch calendar with a single large page for each day, so the sticker is clearly visible. Then, at the end of the day, visit the calendar together and discuss what a great job she did when she earned those stickers. Note that these stickers have no cash value. They're just another way to celebrate and reinforce your child's successes. Caution. Don't let this strategy deteriorate into a bribe system where you end up saying something like, "If you just make your bed, I'll give you 2 stickers. There's a fundamental difference between the posture of wheedling and whining and the stance of being hopeful and giving positive reinforcement after getting cooperation. A fun exercise that demonstrates progress. This activity provides a great illustration of just how much progress you really are making, despite the setbacks. Link arms with your child, or put your arms around each other's waists. Together, take 3 steps forward and then 1 step backward. Walk down the sidewalk linked, using the forward then back pattern. Together, in unison, count aloud. 1, 2, 3, forward. 1, back. 1, 2, 3, forward. 1, back. 1, 2, 3, forward. 1, back. Continue this routine together for a few minutes, then stop. Turn around and look back to see how much progress you've made, even though you were going forward and back. You'll be surprised at how far you've really come together. Go back to the basics. At those times when you feel like your family connections have gotten derailed, start getting back on track by reviewing the principles in this book. Here is a checklist to get you refocused. The goal is to eventually answer all these questions in the affirmative. Checklist. Is my approach playful and interactive? Do I show that I genuinely value my child? Do I alert my child to what's coming next? Do I enforce consequences consistently? Do I mean what I say? Do I follow through on my words? Am I responding to misbehavior within 3 seconds? Am I guiding my child through redos? Do I let my child make choices and problem solve? Do I make regular eye contact when I speak? Do I give my child my undivided attention? Do I give whole hand affectionate touches? Do I make affirming, warm comments? Do I behave consistently? Do I facilitate joint problem-solving with my child? Do I help my child self-regulate and develop self-awareness? Do I encourage my child to tell me his or her feelings? Do I ask my child what he or she needs? Do I create a schedule that accommodates my child's fundamental needs? Do I simplify my life enough that I can give my child my attention? Before your child can blossom. Remember that a flower can't blossom until it has been planted in nourishing soil and given regular waterings and daily sunlight. In the same way, don't expect to uncover the real and glowing, wonderful, self-aware creature your child can be until you've provided for all of his or her physical and emotional needs. A pyramid diagram is a reminder of how different types of care build on each other to heal an at-risk child. Before your child can progress to the pinnacle and become fully connected to himself, his family, and the world around him, all the lower levels of needs must be achieved. At the bottom are physical needs, then rising higher are safety, balance, communication, self-esteem, and at the top, the connected child. Think about whether you are consistently giving your at-risk child all the elements he or she needs to feel fully connected. Sometimes the obstacles to a child's healing are his parents' own psychic wounds. Read chapter 12 and consider whether there is something in your own life that is holding you back from giving your child the deep tenderness and full attention he or she deserves. Healing yourself can be a critical step in helping your at-risk child. If you are consistently using all the techniques described in this book and still are unsatisfied with the progress your child is making, there may be additional physical factors involved. Be sure to consult with a neurologist who specializes in early developmental issues. He or she can give you greater understanding of the challenges your child faces. Chapter 12. Healing Yourself to Heal Your Child. It may seem counterintuitive, but sometimes a child's improved behavior makes a parent uncomfortable. As the child gets healthier, capable of making eye contact, giving genuine hugs, and wanting affection, the more these parents distance themselves. The child's new capacity for closeness puts these parents' own intimacy skills to the test. The truth is, just as adopted and foster children can struggle with baggage and invisible wounds from their past, so can adults. Some emotionally wounded parents instinctively stay at arm's length to protect their child from potential pain and do not realize the trade-off. These parents can provide exceptionally competent physical care, yet on an emotional level remain remote and disconnected. There are other parents who struggle with feelings of inadequacy and desperately want their adopted child to excel and bolster their egos. We have also met parents who are preoccupied with grief over a different child, one who was lost earlier, and as a result are emotionally unavailable or have confused expectations of the little one who needs their care today. Any unresolved memory or trauma that makes you emotionally absent or distracted by the past is bound to have negative repercussions for the child in your care. I struggled with lung infections and asthma as a kid. I remember waking up in the middle of the night, smothered in darkness. My body tightened and clenched as I struggled to breathe. I screamed and screamed and screamed, but no sound came out. I was alone, fighting for my life. As I grew up in my home, interactions with my mom were unpredictable and emotionally scathing at times. Mom would be pretty laid back about chores and stuff around the house. Then she would go into tantrums. I most vividly remember walking through the dining room one day, unaware that she was upset. A plastic cup hit me in the side of the head, and Mom started screaming about no one taking the dishes out of the dishwasher. The cups and glasses continued to fly. I remember looking at the china cabinet and expecting all the glass in it to shatter. I felt frozen in place while Mom continued to rage. When I finally unfroze, I picked up the dishes and put the dishes in the dishwasher. We were kind of the poster family for overachievers, and there was a lot of emphasis placed on grades. From the time we entered third grade until we graduated from high school, the household rule was that if you got a B on your report card, you were grounded for 6 weeks. I can remember coming home with a report card, and the lowest grade on it was a 96. I was proud of those grades and thought my mom would be pleased with my efforts. When I showed the report card to my mother, her only comment was that my grade in math had been a 98 for the last 6 weeks, and now it was a 96. She asked me what the problem was in my math class. It should be no surprise that when I graduated from high school as valedictorian of my class with a grade point average of 98.36, my mother reminded me that it was only the second highest GPA in the school's history, not the highest grade point average. I had managed to successfully fail again. Today, I worry that I might be unpredictable and critical around my kids. I don't want them having the same experience as I had as a kid. So I keep myself removed from them emotionally. I stay at a safe distance to protect them from who my parents were and who I fear I could be. My most emotionally intimate relationships are with people outside my household because I don't want to hurt the people I love the most. I'm not sure how I can reduce those challenges yet. It's a work in progress. I think just getting this honest with myself is an important step. I'm not my mom. I am a kind, generous, and loving person. My kids deserve a chance to get to know me. I think being more vulnerable in my relationships with the kids is important. I believe part of the answer is being willing to laugh with them, cry with them, and hold them when I see they need those things from me, rather than standing back and ignoring what I am seeing. College professor with adopted 2-year-old and 4-year-old children. Sometimes parents fully believe that they have made peace with their own troubling histories, but they have in fact settled on reliable defense mechanisms, such as forcibly suppressing painful memories or obsessively seeking to control others. These wounded but good-hearted people soldier on in the face of profound psychic pain. There are many wonderful, responsible, capable, and self-sacrificing people who carry around unresolved traumas and wounds inside them, and as a result, they are unready to give the deep, nurturing care that an at-risk child requires. Subconsciously distracted by their own needs, these hurting parents can't give full attention to their child's needs or may have unrealistic expectations. Here are some questions to get you thinking about the role that nurturing plays in your life. What is the source of deep comfort and emotional nurturing for you? How do you recognize nurturing? Are you comfortable giving emotional support? How comfortable are you asking others for help? How often do you feel safe around other people? Do you comfort others in order to comfort yourself? Does your own childhood weigh heavily on your heart and mind? Are there ways you are sacrificial in your care of children because you don't believe in your own preciousness? Are you comfortable with emotionally intimate relationships? Are you comfortable with physical affection from friends and family? Are you comfortable cradling your child in your arms for sustained periods of time? Think about these questions because they can offer insight into what nurturing represents to you and how comfortable you are in connecting meaningfully and sensitively with the children in your life. Like parent, like child. Your own emotional and physical well-being has considerable effect on your child. Like parent, like child effects are seen across the board in emotional attachment, social skills, and mood. This phenomenon occurs equally whether your child is adopted or biological. As we explained early in this book, babies develop an attachment style based on their earliest caretaking experience. A baby whose cries are promptly and warmly answered feels well protected and safe with people. This secure baby matures into an adult who is capable of deep and meaningful nurturing. A person who had a harsh or neglectful caretaker, however, learns to avoid people and feels fundamentally uncomfortable with emotions. Babies with unreliable caretakers become fussy and ambivalently attached, while children who received unpredictable and harsh care can become dissociative and confused, growing into adults who both crave and resist emotional closeness. All parents tend to pass down their own attachment style to their baby. For example, an emotionally detached mom is likely to raise an emotionally detached child, who in turn is likely to grow up to become an emotionally detached adult. A mother who never experienced tender nurturing when she was a child is less prepared to offer that to her own child. I've never been good with my own emotions, so it's hard for me to appreciate hers. Mother of an adopted 6-year-old girl. In one research study, more than 70% of the participants had the same attachment style as their mother and grandmother. Because of this effect, it is unlikely that two insecurely attached adoptive parents will be able to help an attachment-disordered child heal and develop into a securely attached family member. A parent's attachment style and emotional health both have significant implications for children. If you are preoccupied with old wounds or subconsciously coping with past traumas, you have less energy to give the full emotional support and nurturing that your at-risk child desperately needs. Gaining insight into your own attachment style. There are a variety of tests to assess an adult's attachment style. When we work with an at-risk adoptive family, we have the parents answer a series of questions called the Adult Attachment Interview, AAI. The AAI explores an individual's recollections of his or her mother, father, and other important childhood caretakers. Answers to these questions help reveal how securely attached this individual was to his or her own parents, and whether he or she currently has unresolved trauma. Although feedback based on the AAI sometimes provides painful insights, it offers a parent a deeper understanding of the healing journey that lies ahead. To give you an idea of how this works, here are a few examples of the type of questions we ask. List 5 adjectives that describe your childhood relationship with your mother during your early childhood before the age of 12. Give a few words to remind you of an event that illustrates each of those adjectives. What happened when you were upset? Reflecting on your own style. If you are curious about what the AAI might reveal about you, think about how you tend to answer questions about your own parents or childhood caretakers. Secure adults answer the AAI questions differently than insecure adults do. If your style is secure, when you are speaking about your parents, you tend to answer questions about them honestly and truthfully. Express appreciation and value for close relationships and bonds. Be comfortable discussing interpersonal connections. Give specific, clear examples that illustrate your observations about the past. Have a balanced perspective on the good and the bad, talking about the failures of your parents as well as the good things, without dwelling on either. Express thoughts using speech that is coherent, with the past distinguished from the present. Have coherent recollections of your childhood with a clear timeline. Display a sense of humor and forgiveness for the past. If your style is insecure, when you are speaking about your parents, you tend to give short, vague, or dismissive answers, or give excessively long and rambling responses that you can't seem to stop. Make broad generalities about the past, but can't give specific, clear examples that illustrate the points. Give misleading or incomplete responses. Use black or white terms, idealizing your parents or denigrating them. Minimize or block out negative experiences. Actively hang on to grudges, anger, and resentments. Have confusing or contradictory details in your stories about them. Have incoherent thoughts or speech. Confuse the past with the present. Risks and recovery. Securely attached adults are better negotiators in close relationships. Only a secure mother can say, "Tell me what hurts, sweetheart," and listen attentively and respectfully to the answer. When an adult is avoiding her own history, entangled in her past, or disorganized about her losses, she can't accurately assess and respond to a harmed child's reality. Only a secure mother can find the heart of the highest risk child. If you did not have safe, nurturing, or warm relations with your family as a child, odds are your own style is insecure. However, be reassured that you can still achieve a secure attachment style if you're willing to face up to your own difficult past. To do that, you'll need to visit the past with ferocious honesty and be willing to explore it and examine it head on. You can come clean about the past in a variety of ways, including keeping a journal about your feelings or history, etc. Drawing pictures about your feelings or history, etc. Talking to a counselor, therapist, or clergy member. Writing a story about it. Taking walks and talking to a friend about it. Writing a letter to the person and then tearing it up and burning it. Accept that what happened to you in the past was not ideal, yet at the same time, you recognize that individuals who hurt you probably did the best they could with the tools they had. Accept that the people who hurt you were laboring under their own demons. Be willing to come to terms with the past and release it, even have a sense of humor about it, then go forward freely in the present. Acknowledging your own personal demons, honoring them, grieving them, and then moving on with an open heart can allow you to heal and become truly present for the child who stands before you now. Finding a therapist. As explained in Chapter 1, we don't recommend talk therapy for language-impaired, attachment-disordered, or sensory-impaired children. However, there are times when a good therapist can help parents, either by aiding your own emotional healing or by providing guidance on the course of treatment for your child. If you do seek a therapist, here are some signs that he or she can benefit your family. The therapist is kind and has a sense of humor about everyone's foibles. The therapist points out the hurt in the child more than the misbehavior. You come away from counseling feeling more warm and compassionate about your child's behaviors and your own. You come away from therapy feeling as if you and your child are a team against the child's harmful past, and it's not you and your child against each other. If you leave a therapist's office experiencing physical distress, such as shortness of breath, or with the urge to run away, you could be having a fear reaction triggered by pain from your own past. Treat yourself gently and take some time to look at issues from your own history that predated your child. Accepting yourself can help you accept your child more wholeheartedly. Healing steps you can take now. You may feel a bit overwhelmed by everything we've shared here. That's okay. It means you have the courage to look in the mirror honestly and recognize opportunities for growth. You have the capacity to move beyond the past and develop new and healthier habits. It just takes a willingness to work and open yourself up to new perspectives. The more secure your style becomes, the richer your relationships will be, and the more healing you can offer a child. The sections that follow have additional steps for you to take along the path to growth. These steps will help you nurture your own spirit as well as that of your child. Unfreeze your feelings. If you were raised in an abusive, harsh, or rageful household, you may have survived by pretending that you didn't care and weren't hurt by what was happening in your home. This is an effective strategy in times of crisis, but suppressing feelings long-term turns into an ingrained, counterproductive habit. Unacknowledged emotions become uncomfortable phantoms that drive you, suffocating your heart and leaving you feeling resentful and intolerant. Often, people who are uncomfortable with feelings choose a career that focuses on intellectual achievement or one that is heavily rule-based. These adults can be highly successful leaders in their communities and performance-oriented achievers in businesses. However, the habit of suppressing emotions can also make it much harder for them to understand and connect with other people, particularly struggling children who are haunted by their pasts and limited by neurological impairments. Are you afraid to admit disappointment, hurt, sadness? If you've gotten in the habit of squelching your own emotions, it's time to relax that rigid stance. Practice identifying and respectfully articulating your own feelings to yourself and to others. Each time that you can identify and appropriately express your own emotions, you take a step on the path toward healing. When a parent models the ability to know and accept personal feelings, it becomes far easier for the child to heal and handle his or her own emotions. I realized that I'm doing a lot of things with my daughter because I need her to make me look good. Because I couldn't have children, I feel pressure to look like the perfect family. Mother of a girl brought home from an Eastern European orphanage. Release yourself from the stranglehold of perfectionism. Perfectionism sets us on a quest for an unreachable standard. We can make ourselves miserable with it. Perfectionists are always hauling their heavy expectations up a steep mountain and never stopping long enough to enjoy the view. It's okay that your children aren't immaculately dressed or youthful prodigies. Remember that no one ever died because her clothes didn't match perfectly, and that academic excellence does not guarantee happiness. Celebrate the delights that are already in front of you, and forgive yourself and your children for not being perfect. You are precious and marvelous, and so are your children. Every day, work to appreciate the innate wonder of your unique perspectives, talents, and joys. Be compassionate about neediness. All children are needy. Nature designed them to be dependent on adults for more than a decade of their lives. In the case of adopted and foster children, this neediness is magnified. Children from hard places require extra nurturing and attention because of the days, weeks, and months of care they missed at critical stages early in life. If you have preconceived ideas about how much neediness is acceptable, you may subconsciously or consciously resent your child, setting up a barrier to warmth and intimacy. How do you feel about neediness? Are you subconsciously angry when you recognize neediness in someone else? Were your needs often overlooked when you were a young child? Do you find it hard to admit your own needs now? These are important questions to consider. Accepting and addressing a child's needs helps him or her feel more accepted and empowered, and it builds a substantial trust account. In the same way, by addressing your own needs, as appropriate within the constraints of parenting priorities, you can reduce your stress and any resentfulness you feel about your child's ongoing needs. It's important to find ways to replenish your body and spirit. Become comfortable with touch. Safe touch is therapeutic, not just for children, but for adults, too. Perhaps you've been unconsciously or unintentionally depriving yourself of the joy of touch. Make a conscious effort to seek out hugs and touch in healthy, appropriate ways with your children or your spouse. Husbands and wives can proactively incorporate it into their daily routine with a bedtime foot rub, hand rub, or back rub. Not only is massage relaxing, it benefits your brain chemistry. Research has found that massage reduces levels of the stress marker cortisol by 30%. It also increases two important neurotransmitters, serotonin and dopamine, by an average of 28% and 31%, respectively. Healthy touch boosts your well-being. Refill the bucket. Many of the parents who come to us seeking help are suffering from emotional and physical exhaustion. It's as if their fuses are blown. Over time, coping with at-risk children has eroded their social support, familial support, and marital support systems. Everyone is tired, and the resources are diminished, so the challenge seems greater. On a basic physiological level, parents need to replenish themselves. It's essential for the entire family's well-being. Without refilling your own bucket, you can't effectively offer healing to your children. Here's a simple stress-busting exercise you can do immediately. Check your shoulders. Are they hunched over uncomfortably? Are the muscles so tight that your shoulders are sitting too high? Purposely drop your shoulders, letting them relax and slide lower while you sit up straighter. Take a long, deep breath and let it out slowly. Breathe deeply and let it out slowly at least 3 times. Continue to let your shoulders loosen. Practice this short routine several times a day to diffuse your own stress. Here are additional measures we recommend to start refilling your own bucket. Get exercise and start today. Even 15 minutes of walking will help bring down your stress and cortisol levels. Take a multivitamin and mineral supplement daily. Take a fish oil capsule daily. Arrange your schedule so that you can get more sleep. Avoid sugary drinks and snacks, which make your blood sugar crash. Try to reduce your caffeine intake. Sit quietly and listen to soothing music or a relaxation tape. Give and receive a great hug. Get and give a massage or foot rub. Be creative about finding reasons to laugh. Try to make time to have fun and play. Make time for private time with your spouse. Seek spiritual comfort in whatever manner is most comfortable for you. Ask a trusted friend or family member to babysit so you can take a night off. You may need to train someone to care for your child or create a cooperative exchange with other parents. Become emotionally present. What does it mean to be emotionally present for a child's needs? Here's a story to illustrate. Imagine you're a stay-at-home mother caring for 3 young children. This morning, you found peanut butter on the television screen and jelly on the doorknob. Your 2-year-old has found your red lipstick and used it on your white bedspread. Another child has overturned your jewelry box, and now one of your diamond earrings is lost in the deep carpet forever. At the supermarket, someone left a big dent in the side of a car you just had repaired. The minute your husband comes home, you begin to whine and wail about your terrible day. You tell him how you're absolutely exhausted and what a nightmare it's been. Of the choices below, which husband's response would you prefer? Husband A says, "I've told you many times that I can help you organize your time and days to be more efficient with the children and the household." Then he leaves the room and begins reading the newspaper. Husband B says, "Why are you trying to ruin my day? Don't you know what a hard week this is for me?" Then he leaves the room and turns on the television. Husband C says, "Oh, sweetheart, I'm so sorry it's been such a hard day. How can I help?" Then he gives you a hug and lets you put your head on his shoulder. Most of us would prefer the support offered by husband C. Husband A has given a brief condescending lecture that hints at problem solving, but doesn't acknowledge your emotional experience or offer any immediate help. Meanwhile, husband B is so wrapped up in his own life that he can't even see that your miserable day wasn't about him. In these situations, you end up only feeling more frustrated, lonely, and hurt. Husband C is emotionally present and securely attached. He is a safe audience. He is willing to see the pain through your eyes, and he acknowledges it. He offers comfort and assistance in a meaningful way. He lets you have the space you need to take control of your own problem. With his reassurance, you find that you can get your feet back underneath you and address the challenges in an orderly fashion. Husband C isn't tangled up in his own pressing needs. He is responding fully to you in this moment, and presumably you, as his spouse, would do the same for him at a time when he most needs it. This quality of being fully present is what we want to provide for our children. We want to be a safe audience and eager cheerleaders for them. We want to let children know that we truly hear their concerns and that it's okay for them to have their feelings. We want to encourage them to be the most that they can be. When we can achieve that, we lay the foundation for true healing and growth. Going forward. If you haven't been reaching your child as quickly as you had hoped, go easy on yourself. As we've said before, mastering any new skill takes time. Both you and your child are learning together. The analogy that comes to mind is that you and your child are being asked to team up and perform an unfamiliar dance together. Both partners are struggling to observe, get coordinated, and learn the new steps. This is a shared process that, with practice, will soon seem effortless. Be patient with yourself and your child as you learn the new steps. Applaud yourself for having the courage and heart to bring healing and love to a child who needs you so. Learn to celebrate small successes and recognize everyday miracles. We wish you all the best on your family's journey toward healing. This is Anna Crow from McGraw-Hill Professional. Thank you for listening. This audiobook is copyrighted in 2019 in the names of Karen Brand Purvis, David R. Cross, and Wendy Lyons Sunshine, and is based upon the book The Connected Child, written by Karen B. Purvis, Ph.D., David R. Cross, Ph.D., and Wendy Lyons Sunshine. Copyrighted in 2007 in the names of Karen Brand Purvis, David R. Cross, and Wendy Lyons Sunshine. To purchase other McGraw-Hill Professional audiobooks, please visit Amazon.com. To purchase other McGraw-Hill Professional products, please visit our website at www.mhprofessional.com.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.